Are you ready for the entertainment experience of a lifetime? Knockdown, Dragout, hard-hitting conversations, debates, and interviews. Well, if you said yes to any of these questions, sit back, relax, and enjoy something like no other. This is the Isolation Series Podcast, presented by the Scott Robles team at Douglas Elliman Real Estate, by WellbeingsPerformance.com for all your online meeting needs, by Barbarian Steakhouse, Canada's premier upscale restaurant. For more information, go to Barbarians.com. By ImprintPilates.com Toronto and the Greater Toronto Area's premier Pilates studio. And by the Toronto Immune and Digestive Health Institute. For more information, go to TIDHI.ca. Here now is your host, Spencer Miller.
Hey guys, and welcome to another edition of the Isolation Series. With me, Spencer Miller, very pleased to be joined, as always, by my co-host Paul Shields on this Friday, May 3rd, 2024. And Paul, let's jump right in. I want to get your thoughts first and foremost, not on the NHL story from last night, but on the NBA story, because the Milwaukee Bucks exited the playoffs pretty handily by the Indiana Pacers last night. I believe it was a 22-point victory, if memory serves correct. But then one of the biggest douchebags that's been in the NBA for a while now, Patrick Beverley, got into it with fans and was doing some egregious things towards the end of the game as a sore loser. And we've seen this from Patrick Beverley before. But I guess my question to you to start off today's show is, what do we make of athletes continuing to be babies in certain situations towards fans? Like, you can be babies all you want about calls by the refs, and we see that all the time, including about a week and a half ago when LeBron James was jumping up and down and throwing a tantrum and everything like that. We know that that's going to happen at least once a game towards an official, but why do it towards fans?
Yeah, you know what? I'm of two thoughts here, right? Like, a guy like Patrick Beverley, like, his act is getting a little bit old. You know, like, he's been an effective player. He's obviously, you know, made a great career in the NBA. So I feel like some of these antics or this gimmick is a little bit much, and it does come off a pretty whiny, pretty, like, a lot very crybaby-like for me. But I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind is we all have been sitting next to the fan who has been inappropriate, who says things that you're like, I would never say that to another human, right? The idea of what we see, what people say about these athletes personally online, like, it can get disgusting. And we know that. So I don't know what happens to instigate something like that with a guy like Patrick Beverley. Like, I don't know what happens there. Again, having not seen it in real time, having only seen the highlights and some of the you know, chatter online about it this morning, I don't know what happened. It comes off really, really, you know, like a sore loser, very petty. But again, I tend to lean towards the athletes in this situation because I know, and you know, everybody listening knows just how awful people can be to one another. So I maybe give a little bit more leeway. I don't think it's appropriate to throw a basketball at somebody or whatever, you know, he was doing at the end of the game. But I can see where fans can also get out of hand. So I do think that there's blame on both sides when it comes to some of those incidents.
I agree with you. And so, moving to the bigger picture here, what does this do if you are a part of the Milwaukee Bucks organization? Obviously, they are just a few years removed from winning their first championship in a long, long time. But largely, the argument has been made and continues to be made now that they haven't been able to perform up to expectation since Giannis came on the scene. And I agree with that 100% wholeheartedly. You have Chris Middleton. You brought in Damian Lillard from Portland thinking, okay, we can make another push to the championship. And we also know that winning a championship in any sport is remarkably hard to do year in and year out. That's why when you see, you know, the Kansas City Chiefs of the world winning back-to-back championships and now going for a three-peat, or when you see the Chicago Bulls, Michael Jordan era, going for two three-peats broken up by a couple of years of him playing Major League Baseball, it is even more difficult than people initially think, I believe. So my question, again, going back to the beginning of this, is what do you do in Milwaukee now? Because there's a lot more questions than answers.
You know, I think that if I'm the Bucks, I think a few things really derailed the end of the year. I think first and foremost, we can't overlook that injuries hit them at the worst time. Right. Like Giannis gets that calf injury in the final week of the season. So he's, you know, not playing or playing hurt. You know, he's in this series. You look at more pressure goes on a guy like Lillard, and then he has an Achilles issue and misses, you know, games 4 and 5 and then plays hobbled on game 6. Middleton is another big piece. He's hurt. Bobby Portis is ejected in a game. Like, there was sort of just some tough moments of injuries or bad decisions that hit the Bucks at the worst possible time. I also wonder about the head coaching carousel, you know, with the Bucks right now. It seems that they're going through coaches too fast, and maybe that's the pressure of expectations. We've talked about this before, results-driven industries, professional sports. Professional sports coaches are hired to be fired. But it just feels like a team that's this good and has this level of talent has some instability that I think they could really calm the waters and you know, set a standard and keep to that. I also think you're looking at a team that's usually very good at defense, but ended up near the bottom third of the league in defense for the first time in quite some time, right? So
Sticking with that narrative, though, Paul, what do you make of Doc Rivers? Because you and I talked about this when Adrian Griffin was let go as their head coach, first-year head coach after being an assistant under Nick Nurse in Toronto for years and years. And at the time of his firing, the Bucks were 30-11 or 30-12 or something like that. And so red flags were brought up around the league knowing that you have a record of 30-12. You're near the top of your division, if not at the top of your division at that time. And you get rid of him and bring in Doc Rivers. Now, we don't know if that was a Giannis thing. We don't know if that was a Giannis and Dame thing. And we'll never really know that in the end. But for as much as I want to respect Doc Rivers, really, when it comes right down to it, Paul, what has Doc Rivers done of consequence since 2008 when he won his one and only championship with the Boston Celtics with one of the first super teams of Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, and Kevin Garnett?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a tough narrative to shake when you look at some of the playoff performances, but I have a hard time laying this one at Doc's feet. Again, like for all the reasons that I just said, like this team was anything but stable this year. And I find it really hard to judge a coach, even a coach with as much history as Doc, on, you know, essentially half a season and one playoff round. Right. I don't think that's, you're not going to get the full picture of what a coach can do with a group in that amount of time. We're talking about, you know, what, 50 games or so, a little less than that with Rivers and this group. So I kind of have a hard time throwing this at his feet. I can understand the disappointment, but I think that if you're the Bucks, you need to look at, you know, defensive structure. What was working before that didn't work this year? What are other teams figuring out? How do you create more space for guys like Lillard and Giannis? And I don't think that there's a whole lot, or in my opinion, there shouldn't be a whole lot of panic here. You're not going to win a championship every year. We know that. You talked about it as you were leading up in the question here. It's real hard to be at the top of the mountain for any length of time. So a little bit of that, roller coaster can happen to good teams. So I think in this case, there's been a lot of change. They've made a lot of big decisions, whether it's coaching and players, et cetera. What I think they need is a little bit of stability. And that's not to say that they're not going to have personnel come and go, right? Players change, you know, some management folks might change and, you know, whatever the structure looks like, people get other jobs with other teams, et cetera, et cetera. But I think stability is what this team needs. And I would like to see what Doc can do, because I think the world of Giannis and Dame. I think they are two of the best players in the league. I love watching them play. So I would trust my horses to run, you know, I'd open the barn and let them run. So I don't know that a whole lot needs to be done with that team other than a full year together with some stability.
Do you believe that there was missing cohesion between Dame Lillard and Giannis throughout the course of the year? Because, I mean, they did get a chance to play a fair amount of the year together, minus some injury stints and whatnot. But there was a lot of narrative leading into the playoffs that there wasn't as much cohesion between the two stars as possible. And as we know, in professional sports, it is very hard to get two alpha dog players to be on the same page and to share the basketball. But you would have assumed that having Giannis to be able to have a sidekick the caliber of Damian Lillard, arguably for the first time in his career, that is a recipe for success right there, but it didn't translate.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say. I don't think you can overlook that, right? But I don't think it'd be the first time we saw star players sort of struggle to find out how to play together, right? So I
see the Brooklyn Nets, where they only played together, I believe, a total of 32 games in something like 3 years.
Yeah, that's a great example, right? They load up that team, and for one reason or another, they just couldn't get everybody on the floor at the same time. So, I think that that's fair. And that is where I have a hard time, again, sort of laying this all on Doc or laying it all on whoever. Pick the person you choose to blame here, right? I think that there's enough blame to go around, but they have enough pieces and enough pedigree to have this team look a lot better next year. And I think that there's just something about this squad. I don't know that, again, we're looking at some of my favorite players in the league, so I'm probably biased when we're talking about what should be done there. And again, to be clear, I'm not a Bucks fan for anybody who might be listening for the first time. I just think that those are two real good players. And with an offseason, with a full training camp, with a coach like Doc who's been there and done that and worked with big egos and seen superstar players play together, et cetera, et cetera, I just think that there is an opportunity here for this team to be real good. And I know it's disappointing now, but I wonder what this team will look like next year.
Moving to the Philadelphia 76ers and the New York Knicks, man, was this one of the more entertaining first-round matchups that we've seen in a long, long time. Last night's contest was another back-and-forth 15-round heavyweight fight from the 70s/early 80s. Ultimately, the New York Knicks were able to prevail, unlike the previous game when you thought that they were going to win with 2 minutes left, and then they had that collapse on the back of 46 points scored by Philadelphia 76ers star Tyrese Maxey. Maxey had a difficult time in last night's game, only scoring, I believe, about 14 or 15 points and not having a good shooting night overall. We understand that this happens in sports from game to game as well. But what do you make of the New York Knicks finally closing the door on the Philadelphia 76ers? Because if I'm the Indiana Pacers, this is setting up for me to be an old school heavyweight tilt between these two teams starting this weekend. That reminds me of Antonio Davis, Dale Davis, Reggie Miller, John Starks, Patrick Ewing, Charles Oakley, and so many others of the 90s that made that rivalry so great.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if for Raptors fans, you got to be I don't know, personally, as a Raptor fan, I had a little smile on my face just watching OG play against Embiid, right? We saw it was, you know, the Raptors championship year was a little bit of the OG Anunoby coming out party. And again, you know, he was dominant in a way against a very good player. And I know Embiid was dealing with injury, and I don't want to downplay that, but like OG did pretty much everything you could. And then, you know, puts the exclamation point on the game and maybe on the series with that big dunk over Embiid. So, yeah, I think that's, well, that's, again, if you're a Knicks fan, that's what you got that guy for. Right. So, and as far as what's coming next there, it's nice to see, I think the game is better when the Knicks are good, right? It's sort of like, any other sports league, when the teams from New York or the teams in the biggest markets have success, it creates a buzz unlike any other. See, you know, teams like Toronto, New York, Montreal in the NHL, see Dallas in the NFL, right? The Yankees or the Red Sox in Major League Baseball, the Dodgers. When these teams are going well, it's good for the game. And so it's nice to see the Knicks. And I think that part of the fun of a Knicks-Pacers series is, you know, little old Indiana, you know, coming in and scrappy and trying to beat the big bad New York team, right? And regardless of the players on either team, that's sort of the narrative of, like, you know, smaller city, you know, maybe middle America versus the epicenter that is New York City. So, you know, I totally agree with all of the names that you brought up and that harken back to those 90s that 90s rivalry. But I think that the it becomes something more, right, to the people in those cities and to the fans of those teams. And I think it's going to be really exciting.
Finishing the basketball story for this Friday, May 3rd on the Isolation Series, then tomorrow we are treated to the beginning of one of the marquee second round matchups that we've seen in a long time. And that is Anthony Edwards, Karl Anthony Towns, going into Ball Arena in Denver in altitude to take on Nikola Jokic, Jamal Murray, and the Denver Nuggets. We know that Karl Anthony Towns and Anthony Edwards are a dynamic, formidable duo, no doubt about it. But as we talked about already a couple of times throughout these playoffs, Nikola Jokic is primed to win another MVP of the league this year, more than likely, if Shai Gilgeous-Alexander does not dethrone him. And Jamal Murray, despite his poor shooting a couple of games throughout the first round, he was able to throw two unbelievable daggers to end off the last series versus the Lakers. So what do you make of this series on both ends starting tomorrow?
Feels a bit like a heavyweight fight. Eh? It feels like, with no disrespect to the Thunder or either the Mavericks or the Clippers, like this almost feels like an Eastern Conference, or excuse me, a Western Conference final. Right, just with the way these two teams have played, the names that you mentioned, the stage feels big, right? So I think that it's going to be a great series. It wouldn't surprise me to see this go seven games, We're talking about a 2 seed versus a 3 seed, and teams that are really well matched. So I think I'm looking forward to that as we creep towards the NBA finals here. And I think that I feel like the winner of this series is the team that's going to the NBA finals. I don't know why I feel like that. It's just these two teams look unstoppable. And I know it's hard. The Thunder just completely swept the Pelicans, right? So it's hard to – I don't mean to discredit them. There's just something about these two teams that feel like one of them is headed to the finals for me.
I completely agree with you on that, which is scary in its own right on a Friday, May 3rd edition of the show, but I digress.
Don't go agreeing with me too much. It's Friday, you know. I'll get a big head going into the weekend.
Yes, well – the argument can be made that you might have that big head despite what I do.
Totally possible. That's totally possible.
Yes. moving to the National Hockey League, I want to get your thoughts on what we saw last night in Toronto, Game 6, Scotiabank Arena. The Toronto Maple Leafs once again stayed off elimination to tie up the series 3-3. And it was a really well-played game overall by this team that was down their number one goal scorer yet again for the second straight game in Austin Matthews plus a period. We don't know what his status is going to be ahead of tomorrow's game. I would be surprised if he plays in tomorrow's game as well. Now, I know that you're not a big fan of the word momentum here, Paul, especially going into the playoffs and going through the playoffs and whatnot. And we also know that the beauty of Game 7 is that it's do or die. Anybody can win at any time and whatnot. And they have, in the Toronto Maple Leafs, picked themselves up off the mat to get themselves back in the series. So from that perspective, do you ride any type of emotion going into tomorrow's Game 7, do or die? Or do you just focus on what you need to do, and that's be a professional hockey player to the highest level one more time to get past the so-called boogeyman of the Boston Bruins?
Yeah, I think if you're the Toronto Maple Leafs, you have to keep doing what you have been doing, right? In games, in Game 5 and Game 6, the idea of, you know, blocking shots and playing within a structure and, you know, waiting for your opportunities at taking advantage of those opportunities when you get them, because we know that they have been few and far between. They've had to work hard to get the chances on Swayman, and then he's been playing incredible. So just the persistence to stick to the process, I think, is maybe one of the bigger differences I've seen in this Leafs team versus teams of the past. I think that there was a lot of, emotion is always part of any sporting event, whether you're amateur or pro or whatever. There's emotion involved in any game. It's part of what makes it fun and makes us, you know, engage with it as fans or as players. But I think that it's harnessing that energy and staying within a system. If you look at this series, the Leafs have been the better team at 5-on-5. They have struggled because their special teams wasn't very good. They're down. They're -5 or something. We talked about it with Kyle on the last show. But the reality is that when the switch to Joe Wall has made a big difference, right? He looks very calm and he's making some very big saves for them. And part of that is helping their penalty kill stay even. So yes, the power play has been a bit of a nightmare, but if you're not giving up goals on your penalty kill, then it's less of an issue, particularly with how well they've been playing 5-on-5. And again, last night, they stuck with the program. They stuck with the system. So if you're the Toronto Maple Leafs, you got nothing to lose here. You have managed for, you know, arguably the first time in the Matthews-Marner era, you have managed to push the pressure of a Game 7 onto your opponent more so than the Leafs. And I want to be clear as far as all the players feel pressure. Leafs players feel it, Boston players feel it. But the narrative around this game is much less about, oh no, the Leafs are in another Game 7 in round one, and very much onto the Bruins of, will they be the first team in the Big Four professional sports to lose a 3-1 lead 2 years in a row as the top seed? That is pressure, right? That is the narrative being pushed onto the players. Like, don't kid yourself. The Boston media is just as ruthless and savage as the Toronto media, right? They've just had more to cheer about and less to complain about because that team has won so much and teams in Boston have won so much in recent years. So don't, you know what I mean? Like, don't downplay how intense it can be in other markets because we are also in an intense market. So I thought the Leafs played a really great game. I think you can't say enough about Joe Woll. Willie Nylander is looking like himself. And as far as the Austin Matthews status, I believe that we're in injury territory now. If he was sick, he wouldn't be around the team as much as he is. And he wouldn't be trying to skate before practices and trying to get on the ice and not being able to go and being, you know, taken off by doctors, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know what the status is going to be in game seven. Like you said, it certainly doesn't look good as to what we've seen over the last couple of days, but this team looks like a team that does not want to start their summer early. And I think as a fan with two teams that are as close as these two teams are, all you can ask is that the Leafs show up and play like a team that doesn't want to go home. So I like that about their effort, and I was pretty happy with the game last night.
Knowing the Toronto media, though, and you said it, that they are ruthless like the Boston media is, knowing the Toronto media, though, depending on how the Leafs come out in Game 7 tomorrow and play, can you see the Toronto media finding the silver lining that they did play well when their backs were against the wall? Or if they do end up losing tomorrow's Game 7 again, despite what they did to put themselves back in the series when their back was against the wall, all that will be forgotten. And it'll be about the core four again and the whole narrative and Brendan Shanahan and everything like that, which, again, let me be clear, I'm not saying that that shouldn't be the narrative in a lot of ways, but just based on the last couple of games, has it bought them a little bit of a reprieve in your estimation?
Yeah, I think it all depends on what happens. I think, you know, we're all aware of the fact that the Leafs, like the Cowboys or like the Yankees, right? They have such a rabid fan base that is so big that it can create enemies of basically the entire league. So we know that articles, you know, talking about the Leafs' demise do better than articles praising the Maple Leafs. We've seen it our whole lives. That's just the reality of it. So the Leafs get to choose what the narrative is when we wake up on Sunday morning. If they go out and they play the way they have in the last couple games and they're able to win, then the narrative switches from now, can this team overcome a Florida team that beat them badly last year? Right? What does this team look like now in the second round? 2 years in a row in the second round. That's a more positive spin than they lost again to Boston, you know, fourth time in the since 2013. They've lost to Boston in a game seven, yada, 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 right? So I think that no matter what happens, the Leafs have the opportunity to control the narrative. If they go in and they lose and they don't look very good, well, then we know what that's going to look like. And I think there's change coming in this offseason, regardless of what happens, save for a Stanley Cup run. I think that there's going to be some big changes, whether it's to the core or to the coach management group of the Maple Leafs. I think that change is coming, and I think that they know that. And so they look like a team that doesn't want to change. They look like a team that wants to stick around and keep playing together. And again, that's all you can ask.
Outside of our bias here on the Isolation Series, then, I'm going to put you on this spot, Mr. Paul Shields, and ask you, do you believe that the Leafs have done enough in the last couple of games to give you the confidence to say going into game seven tomorrow in enemy territory in TD Bank Garden in Boston that they will slay the dragon that is the Boston Bruins?
I think that you know, breaking curses is not an easy business. And this Maple Leafs team has been nothing if not cursed for the better part of the last, you know, just south of 60 years. So I think that they took a hard road to get here, but I do think that they can get it done on Saturday night. Now, let's be very clear. I'm not going to bet against the Leafs. You could told me that. You could ask me that after before each game. I've been nervous. I've been anxious. I was cheering for them, but I didn't know if they could get it to this game seven and the way that they looked in the first couple games of the series. But if this is the team that we see moving forward, they have an excellent shot to make it to the second round and be a real problem for the Florida Panthers.
I agree once again. Wow, that's like the third time I've agreed with you already today. This is getting a little scary in its own right. Moving to the Western Conference of the National Hockey League, I want to get your thoughts on the Vancouver Canucks and Nashville Predators. They are taking place with their next game in Nashville tonight after the Canucks failed to close out the series at home a couple of nights ago. What do you think is going to happen tonight in Smashville? We know that fan base can be very ravenous in its own right. And we know that if UC Soros gets on a roll, he's one of the elite goaltenders in the NHL. So do you believe that Vancouver somehow gets it done in a hostile territory? Or do they have to push it back to Vancouver in order to finish it out?
I'm a little worried about Vancouver, if I'm being honest. I think that to give them all the credit, when Thatcher Demko went down, I thought that he covered a lot of the defensive lapses from a Vancouver team that's real good, but has a penchant for making you know, some big mistakes on their own end. They get away with it because they have such a great goalie. Then DeSmith comes in and they play great in front of him. Silovs comes in, they play great in front of him. So I think that this team really figured out how to play playoff hockey. I am a little concerned about the shots on goal. They're just not getting and generating the chances in the last couple games that you'd like to see to finish out a team. Nashville's going to be pesky. I think they're going to hang around. I would like to see Vancouver finish it out tonight, but I really have a sense we're going to seven games here.
Right. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And I'm going to ask you this very question, moving to Major League Baseball for a moment. We know that the Toronto Blue Jays embark on another 7 or 8 game road trip through Washington and Philadelphia, respectively, before returning home a week from tonight to take on the Minnesota Twins. What do you anticipate coming into this road trip? Do you think that the Blue Jays will right the ship of the last couple of weeks, or has this team, like we discussed with Kyle earlier in the week, not instilled any confidence in its fan base as of late, so you don't really know from game to game what team you're going to get?
Yeah, I think that we're going to get, you know, if it's an 8-game road trip, we're going to get a 4-4 road trip. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, this team is so painfully mid. It's hard to get too excited. And it's kind of hard to, I'm struggling to be too upset about it because, like, this is the team. Like I said the last time we talked, like I've said many times we've talked about it, until this team does something dramatic or dramatically improves the offense, I feel like it's Groundhog Day. Like, we're just going to be talking about a 500 ball club that needs better hitting from their top end players, and about a manager who feels completely handcuffed and doesn't change up the roster in a way that makes any sense for my sensibility. And look, let's be real clear. When we talk about hockey, I feel like I have a very good understanding. That's a game that I follow. I like to dig in the stats. I love looking at the players, the game that I play actively still. So I feel like when I'm talking about hockey, there's a knowledge there. So I can be a little more unbiased when we're talking about teams other than the Maple Leafs, who I'm very biased for, obviously. When it comes to baseball, I'm just a fan. So I don't get all that deep into the analytics of baseball. And because the statistics there are quite frankly overwhelming for me in a lot of ways. But when I, through my lens as a fan of the sport, when I watch this team, I just don't see anything to be excited about.
Right. So what you're saying is, in your estimation, right now we should change our leadoff hitter from George Springer to Phil Connors.
I would try literally anything. Why not? They haven't been good enough to stick with what they're doing. They haven't been bad enough to, you know, blow everything up and start anew, right? So just why don't you try? I'm not saying that there's not good players on this team, right? And the pitching, again, has been very good. They're giving this team a chance to win. So if what's not working is the hitting in Major League Baseball, to me, and you would be more of an expert on this being as close to the game as you are, but hitting at the Major League level, so much of it feels like rhythm to me. Guys have this, you know, essence about when they are hitting well, they're seeing the ball. There's just this way about hitting that you find your rhythm and you just try and ride it as long as you can. That's the grind of baseball, right? Is trying to be a good player over 162 games. But right now there's no rhythm. Every single batter feels like they're out of step. Even the ones that are hitting well, I don't feel like we're maximizing those who are hitting the ball, because it just feels like we're in this Groundhog Day loop over and over again. So I just do something, anything.
Getting back to the conversation that we had earlier in the week with Kyle Smith, then, do you believe that something drastic needs to happen in terms of looking to trade Vladimir Guerrero Jr. more so now than ever before? Because do you believe somebody like that and the attitude that comes with it, good, bad, or indifferent, or lackadaisical at different times, is becoming a distraction for the rest of this team in some capacity?
I don't know. I don't know that he's a distraction, and I don't know that I would... I don't know that I'd be giving up on Vladdy just yet, but I also think that you have to be realistic about what's next for this team. So, you know, if you're looking ahead and you don't think Vladdy is the player we thought he was, then you have to explore that. I think that you're not doing your job if you're not. But again, like we've talked about it so many times, I don't trust this management group. So like, what are we going to go get for Vladdy? They've literally, like, if we were to start talking trade with Vladimir Guerrero right now, what is his value even at? I still think that you would get good return for that. We talked about it with Kyle. But it's a tough situation. I still think that there's promise in Vladdy, and like I said before, I think that there are a number of GMs out there who just think they're smarter than the next guy, and that they have a way to bust through and find a way to make this player go. So I think if someone is going to blow your doors off with a trade, you have to consider it. I think you have to make it a good one, because that could be a legacy altering style trade. Right. And so if you're going to make that trade, if you're Ross Atkins, if you're Mark Shapiro, and you're going down that road, you better get it right.
Do you think, cause I've heard a lot of narrative lately around this team that they need to make a trade similar to what they did in December of 1990, where they traded a beloved Toronto Blue Jay member at the time, Fred McGriff, and Tony Fernandez for Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar. Now, I understand that the game has changed drastically in a multitude of ways since 1990, because obviously that is 34 years ago. But would you look at doing a double trade necessarily of, let's say, Bo Bichette and Vlad, to see if you can sweeten the return, whatever it happens to be? Because like I said, I've heard a lot of people in the Blue Jays sort of media and callers alike saying that they need to pull off another Tony Fernandez, and Fred McGriff for Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar's situation.
I think that's kind of the trade I would like, the level of trade I would be talking about. To me, those are change of scenery trades, right? You had good players who weren't playing at the level you were hoped they could. You move them on, who, and they both continue to be very good players after playing for the Jays. But you get an Alomar, you get a Carter, you change sort of the dynamic of your team without losing some of the skill or experience, right? And so I think that if you can find a trade like that, if there is a player out there that would be in the same conversation as Vlad Guerrero Jr., who is maybe underachieving, who maybe needs that change of scenery. Yeah. Like that's the type of trade I would be looking for. That, or you have to get a ridiculous package of picks and prospects. And, you know, you're either trading to stay at the level you are and get better, or you're trading to get worse in the short term to get better in the long term. So they have to make a decision on where the team is. But yeah, I think that, you know, it's easy to say, oh boy, you know, the Raptors have to go and make a Kawhi Leonard trade. That's not easy. The Jays have to go and make a Joe Carter, Robbie Alomar trade. That's, give that a shot, right? See how easy that is. But I do understand why people are talking about it. And yeah, I think it's a great, I think that's exactly the type of trade you'd want to do right now if you're the Blue Jays.
And to finish the baseball conversation, I know that you don't know very much about this particular individual, but Kyle and I have talked about this particular individual on the program over the last couple of weeks. Subsequently, if you're the Pittsburgh Pirates and you realize that not much is drawing your fan base to your ballpark right now, and you know that you have one of the top pitching prospects in all of baseball waiting just to make his major league debut with a 0.39 ERA, down in AAA with it being Paul Skenes. Now, what do you think they're hesitant on to pull the trigger? Because if I was the Pittsburgh Pirates, I would have brought Paul Skenes up, you know, last month or, you know, 3 weeks ago, because clearly he is overmatched for the level of talent that is currently in AAA.
Yeah, I think, you know, we often have this conversation on the show about when to bring up prospects and what they look like. And I don't know, until a prospect can come up and show that they are a regular, an everyday major league player, they are magic beans as far as I'm concerned. So I just don't have a rush to bring players up. Now, if you're the Pirates and this is a good player who you see being good down the road, you think that you have the right clubhouse, the right coaching staff, the right everything to bring him up and support the ups and downs that come with being a brand new major league player, then yeah, bring him up, you know, give the fans something to be hopeful about, right? You have to, I've heard it said before, you have to sell hope or you have to sell winning. So does he help you sell hope without ruining his long-term, the long-term goal of having him be an effective pitcher on a good baseball team, right? So you have to weigh that. So I tend to be of the belief of, you know, let them dominate for as long as is possible. Let them get all the confidence and all the good habits and all the good things that you need going from being a prospect to being a professional. Then you have to go from being a professional to being a major leaguer. And those are different things. So I think that when I have a slight difference in philosophy around how to handle these prospects, but you know, having watched many a team that was selling hope, I do understand the importance of those young, good players that sort of have management say, like, see, we told you this guy was coming. We told you he was going to be good. I understand the value of that too.
Yes, but we don't have to look too far removed from the Toronto Blue Jays organization. Nate Pearson was thought of as the top prospect in baseball just a handful of years ago. And then they brought him up and he couldn't find his command. And then he had mono issues a couple of years ago and has been up and down ever since. To his credit, he said that he's finally matured a little bit from his previous years and whatnot. So we hope that translates better for him in the major leagues now and whatnot. But he was a top prospect himself with a plus 100 fastball.
Yeah, well, that's a great example, right? He had, how many times did we hear baseball pundits say that he had quote unquote can't miss stuff, right? And to this point, unfortunately, he's missed. And you hate to put it that way because it's unfair to a player who's still very young and still trying to be a major league player. But I mean, these things happen, right? So I think that's what I mean is you got to be real careful with these young players. And I think baseball might be one of the cruelest professional sports. It's a game where you can do everything right and have everything go wrong. And the pitcher has to wear so much of that, whether it's right, you know, or wrong. That's kind of the way it is in baseball. So I think pitching prospects, I would rather overbake a pitching prospect than underbake them and throw them on the mound in a major league game. I'm more likely to pull the trigger on position players faster than I am a pitcher.
Right. It definitely is an evolving, interesting conversation that we continue to have and will continue to have here on the Isolation Series. But is there anything that we haven't covered on this Friday, May 3rd, 2024 edition of the Isolation Series that we should, my friend?
That's setting up to be an exciting weekend. You know, we got two game sixes in the NHL tonight. Means that we have at least one game seven Saturday night. We could have game sevens on Sunday as well. This is the best time of year to be a sports fan. I'm excited. Can't wait to see what happens this weekend. So I'm looking forward to breaking it all down on Monday with you, my friend.
Absolutely. And I want to close out today's show with a little bit of positivity. And I know you're sitting there thinking, but wow, Spence, you're going to end it with a little bit of positivity. I thought that's my job. Well, the shoe is on the other foot today, my friend, because I want to end the show by giving a well-deserved shout out to an individual that you and I have known for a very, very large portion of our lives, respectively, and that is Jody Schnur. Now, for most of you listening, you don't know who Jody Schnur is. Jody Schnur is an educator that has been in education for a long, long time here in the Ontario area and Burlington and Hamilton, Ontario, respectively, around those areas respectively for a long, long time. She was a drama teacher for us in the case of Paul and myself, and she went on to guidance and has been a vice principal now for the last number of years she is about to enter her retirement in just over a month from now. So I wanted to give a big shout out to end today's show on this Friday, May 3rd, to one of our favorite educators of all time, Jody Schnur. She's been affecting a lot of students for a long, long time in a very positive way with a very unique personality, to say the least.
Yeah, one of my all-time favorites, somebody that I think about often, and couldn't have said it better myself, Spence.
Absolutely. So happy retirement for you, Jody, coming up in just over a month's time from now. And thank you for all that you did and do for education and all the people that love you in education and your life, respectively. But for Paul Shields, I am Spencer Miller. This has been another edition of the Isolation Series for Friday, May 3rd, 2024. And as always, we appreciate you watching and or listening wherever it is that you are doing so. We would like to send a big shout out to our sponsors, without whom we wouldn't be able to do this as often as we do, including but not limited to our newest partnership with Fade Room Toronto and Ferreira Signature Line. for all your hair cutting and grooming needs, respectively. Be sure to check out Fade Room Toronto and Ferreira's signature line. But until we come at you with another fantastic edition of the show on Monday, featuring Paul, myself, and Kyle Smith, take care of yourselves and each other. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
And Paul, please tell people all about some more whole grain goodness that is us.
Folks, be sure to check us out on podbean.com by going to theisolationseries.podbean.com. There you'll find the audio-only versions of the podcast, including all of our past amazing interviews. One more time, that's theisolationseries.podbean.com. And hey, don't forget to follow us on Instagram. It's at @vspencermiller and at Pauly Shields, Pauly spelled P-A-W-L-Y. So find us on podbean.com, follow us on Instagram, and don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.
And once again, everybody, thank you for watching and or listening and supporting this thing we like to call the Isolation Series. For Paul Shields, I am Spencer Miller, and we will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.